Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, good afternoon, folks. My name is Vernon Bohr, a.k.a. Vernon, a.k.a. V-Cubed on Block, here on Blog Talk Radio. This is my Saturday afternoon Santa Cruz run. I set it up for people who have listened to me for years on KSCO AM 1080. But everyone's welcome and invited. There's no restrictions on who can come and listen. And over my years at KSCO, I ran into a very bright, very interesting, very charming fellow by the name of Bob Bishop. When I first ran into him, he went by the name Mr. Logic. That's how he was first introduced. And he continues to be on KSCO. I can't even remember. We go back so far. But I wanted to have him on as a guest for a long time, and he graciously accepted. So Bob Bishop, Mr. Logic, is my guest for the day, and we're going to be off and running and have a rousing show. So, Mr. Logic, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing, Vernon?
I'm doing very good. This is your first foray into internet radio, I suspect.
KSCO does streaming audio on the internet, too. So I guess you might say that's maybe counts as internet radio. I don't know. I guess in terms of strictly internet radio without any affiliation with the station, this may be, I guess, the first time.
Yeah, you know, it's been a little over a year now since I've been doing strictly internet radio, and it differs from, as they call it, terrestrial radio in that it's only broadcast over the internet, and that's where the exposure is, and so that no one can really listen to us over the airways unless they have, there are some services out there that I guess you could tie into. I have not set them up. Or you could, in fact, they do have little R radio frequency transmitters you could hook up to your computer that will convert it to an FM signal so you could listen to it on the radio, but it's not a station as such. So anyway, I started this. It was an experiment, and it's been quite interesting over the years. And over the year, a little over a year, I've been here. And I'm glad to have you on as a guest. You have your show right now back on KSCO on Sunday from 11 to 1. Is that not correct?
Yeah, currently it's 11 to 1. It's been moving around for lots of month or so, had me on Sundays and then Saturdays and Saturday evenings. And anyway, I think it's finally stabilized now at 11 to 1 Sunday, well, starting Sunday morning.
There's kind of a Heisenbergian uncertainty in your show then.
Yeah, there's. I guess that's probably typical of the radio station there. There tends to be somewhat chaos going on.
I wonder if it's, do you think it's structured chaos or chaos in its purest sense and form?
I haven't actually been down to the station now physically for a number of years, so I don't know what's going on in terms of the physical organization down there and how things are structured. All I can see is the end result from up here. I'm up in Paradise. I guess you're, are you still in Santa Cruz?
I am still in Santa Cruz, and by Paradise, for those of you listening, I don't think Mr. Logic means that he's traversed to the other side. I think he means...
No, yeah, Paradise is a small town here, and a little bit, about 10 miles from Chico, if you know where Chico is, and if you don't,
yes,
it's north of Sacramento. So that's where I've been for the last 8 years. Oh, no, 10 years. It'll be 10 years this year.
Hard to believe that much time has passed.
Yeah.
You know, so one of the things that Mr. Logic does on his show a lot is a lot of puzzles, and I've called him in the past to have him on my show for a long time. And, you know, let's see, entropy, inertia gets in the way, and I hadn't called him, but something came up this past week that I thought was interesting. I sent him an email. There was a piece that I saw on ABC News where apparently they were saying people should learn to program. And Mr. Logic has developed a programming language called Simple. The actual piece was, Gates, Zuckerberg urge kids to code, and I thought how much ahead of your time you were. So why don't you give the folks a little introduction into your background, where you came from and how you got here. You're very early in the Apple revolution. You did programming for them. Your computer, as I recall, you had serial number 13.
Right.
I don't know if that, you know, that might be appropriate for you.
Well, I started in computing back when I was an undergraduate, actually, at the University of Wisconsin. I was supposed to take a class in programming in the fall, and that summer I got a part-time job working in the library, the math physics library. And if you're familiar with the University of Wisconsin, it's on the edge of a lake, and everybody goes sailing and swimming and canoeing, and especially in the summertime, nobody's going to sit in the library. So here I was in the math physics library in the summertime, sitting behind the desk with nothing to do, and there happened to be a book behind on the shelf behind me, and it was a book by Daniel McCracken called Fortran Programming. So since I'd signed up to take a class in programming in the fall, I decided to get a head start since there was nothing better to do. And I read the book and got hooked, and 3 days later I went out and got a job as a programmer.
What hooked you about programming?
Well, it's fun. I mean, I like doing puzzles and solving problems and that kind of stuff. And if you're that kind of a person, programming is definitely for you. If you're not that kind of a person, that may be a different story. If you don't like to solve puzzles or do thinking exercises, programming may not be your bag. But for me, it was just a perfect niche. So I got into it and started playing around with it and just been doing it ever since.
Well, I did not mind programming, per se, in the days that I did it, and haven't done all that much, not anywhere near what you did. What I did not like is the rigid standards and the intolerance of the programming language for human mistakes.
Well, unfortunately, computers, well, either fortunately or unfortunately, I think it's a bonus, actually, that computers are precise, because trying to do something in an imprecise system can be very frustrating. I mean, try to deal with human beings, for example, and you kind of rack your head against the wall because they just can't listen to you, they don't pay attention. A computer is very predictable, it's very understandable, and you can get places with it where you might not be able to get places with something of a lesser structure.
You know, when you say that, that's come to my mind many times. I think that clearly humans are imprecise systems, and I've often marveled at the fact that on one hand, when you're working with computers and computer systems and networks and things, they attempt to make sure that they understand what's being said, either by demanding that you say it a certain way and that you're clear about what you say, or on networks, you know, there are protocols, things that go back and forth to double-check that they've gotten the message correctly. Whereas in the human condition, And in the human system, that's not quite the case. So you certainly have something there, but do you think the precision in the human case might make the world a little bit boring?
Well, I mean, you might think of it in the extreme sense of maybe a robot, if you wanted to imagine an anthropomorphic robot that emulates a human being. I don't know. I mean, computers, well, there is something in computing called random number generating, which a lot of programmers use when they make games to keep them from being boring and predictable. So you have the option. You can have something nice and uniform and predictable, or if you want to have randomness, you can throw that in too and live in the best of both worlds.
Well, that certainly is true. I've been more and more intrigued as people talk about hitting the singularity where artificial intelligence approaches that of human thinking. I've often wondered how will we know if we ever reach that, when we reach that point, because until computers can move on their own and maybe stop us from hitting the on-off switch, they might just want to keep silent about having achieved that.
Well, see, the thing that I'm interested in computing isn't so much the ability to emulate human beings or human thought. Well, that's an interesting idea in itself. To me, like I said at the beginning, I like them because they pose a way to be creatively, what would you call it, creative puzzle solving, I guess you might call it. Now, before there were computers, if you wanted to do that kind of thinking, you would have to go out and buy a jigsaw puzzle, for example, and then you'd have all these pieces and you got to try to figure out how to put the puzzle together. Or you could get a math book of puzzle questions and they'll have things like, you know, a farmer sells blah, 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 how many, you know, you can solve problems that way. But those aren't very intriguing. I mean, there probably were, you know, back in before there were computing around. But now computers offer the ability to be creative, artistic, solve problems, and come up with ideas that you can test and try. I'm not quite sure how to explain it. I mean, it's like you get an idea. It's almost like a composer who gets an idea for a piece of music or an artist who gets an idea for a picture. Well, with programming, you get an idea for an algorithm, which is kind of not a physical thing that you can hear or see, but it's something you can think about. And when you think about developing algorithms, that's a whole separate kind of creativity, which is similar to music and art, but different in that it's not physical.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is a side note. My background in training was originally in physical chemistry, and the longer I'm around, I see applications of things like statistical mechanics, quantum mechanics, to a generalized overview of the human condition and human behavior. And by that, I mean, in the quantum mechanical sense, what you see is the probabilities of certain states, you know, based on perturbations, but you can't really predict anything about the individual. And it seems to me with computers, there is kind of a natural thinking and simulation you can do that maybe actually gets to the natural laws of the universe. I don't know how you feel about that.
The natural laws of the universe, I guess you might say, are based fundamentally in mathematics, and computers are very good at doing certain mathematical operations. But then a computer can actually do almost anything in terms of simulation. You can simulate not just mathematical states and chemistry states, but you can simulate virtually anything. You can simulate an economic system, if you're interested in economics. You can simulate a war by looking at statistical probabilities of what the enemy's going to do, and so on and so on. So a computer is kind of unique, and that's the first device which is not something that was made to do one particular thing. Like a TV set, all you can do is watch television. A refrigerator, all it does is keep food cold. But a computer can be made to do almost anything. And so it's kind of unique in that respect.
If you know how to talk to it, which brings us to this whole notion of programming. You started off in Fortran, so I assume that you started in the days we had to give the computer a stack of cards.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us a little, tell us how that's changed over the years.
Well, the first, yeah, back when I started, you had to punch in or turn in a deck of punch cards to a computer operator, and then you'd wait while they run the computer, and it usually takes overnight because they do batch processing at night. And the next morning, you'd go in there and find out you forgot to put a comma somewhere, and so your program didn't work, and so you wasted a day, and you got to do it again, start over. So it might take you a couple of weeks to get a program working, whereas nowadays, computing is done pretty much in real time. You write your program, and in a few seconds, you can tell whether or not you got a mistake. So that's, when I think back on it, I'm almost amazed that anybody ever got anything to work back in the old days.
Well, aren't you equally amazed that anyone gets anything to work these days with the sophistication that's available on these things?
By sophistication, what do you mean exactly?
Well, you know, doing things in real time, you know. Let's see, I'm trying to think of a good way to put that. Is you can program things quickly in real time, but it's easy to get, you might get, give computers instructions that they can understand and carry out, but that doesn't necessarily mean you'll get the right results. So that one of the things when I was in graduate school that started to bother me toward the end of my career is that where computers were absolutely fascinating and gave a lot of power to the experimental scientists in terms of analyzing data, they almost kind of took over, and in a way people started to rely on their analytical abilities, their abilities to manipulate data rather than their thinking about the problems. So that's kind of what I mean. You know, you can program computers maybe to give you almost any answer, and maybe what you program to do doesn't give you a result that's right, real, or accurate.
Well, that's, you know, that's a fault of probably an improper algorithm or a bug in the program or any number of things. Yeah, one of the problems with computing is knowing whether or not the result you're getting is meaningful. And that's not a trivial thing to necessarily find out, unless, of course, the program is trivial itself. Like, let's say you're going to write a program. Let's take a trivial case. Let's say you're going to write a program to generate all the prime numbers, which, by the way, was the very first program I ever wrote. Actually, the first one I ever got to run. So you're going to write this program to generate prime numbers. And so you end up getting a table of numbers printed out. Now, how do you know if those are all right? I mean, how do you know you didn't have a problem in your program and you're only getting some of the prime numbers, or maybe some of the numbers aren't prime? How do you know? And that's a question that I guess what you have to do is you need to understand the algorithm itself and then test it and verify it, and then you can be reasonably sure that what you're getting is meaningful. And in a complicated problem, that may be very, very difficult to establish.
Well, I'll give you an example of what I consider to be in a complicated problem, period, or the operating systems we work in. These days, and then you couple that with something called the Internet, you know, we're always getting downloads, patches, and updates because people are finding flaws in the base programming that lead to security holes.
Yeah, that's one example. You know, there's always going to be something somebody finds later on that needs to be fixed. In fact, I'm speaking from experience, going back to my programming language, Simple. I initially created that like over 15 years ago. Actually, it was back in mid-1990s. And over that period of time, I've lost track of the number of updates I've had to make because of mistakes I found, improvements I found, and not necessarily mistakes, but sometimes I'd find a better way of doing something, make it more efficient, make it easier to use, et cetera, et cetera. And so I keep issuing updates almost all the time. In fact, I just issued an update this morning.
And what did it fix? Was it a critical flaw, in your opinion, or?
It was definitely not a critical. In fact, it was so minor, I didn't even issue a revision number. I simply changed some of the documentation that was built in so as to make it a little bit more easy to understand. But
well,
even,
let me ask you. Oh, go ahead.
I was saying, even minor things like that, though, can take a long time and have to be checked out.
How does one go? We have two different levels here. You're at a very interesting level because you're simple as a programming language that people can use to write their own programs. How sophisticated can the programs be?
Did what?
How sophisticated a program could someone write? Could someone write something in simple that really does something? I don't want to diminish the language, but I'm going to use the words powerful and substantive. Let's say with respect to something on the internet, or could you write apps using simple?
I have written apps using simple. In fact, that's one of the things that we have on the website. We're just starting to do apps because I just got my tablet just about a month ago, and already we've got about 15 or 20 apps up on our website, and you can download those free if you have a Windows tablet. And in terms of what you can do almost anything. I mean, I have programs that play chess, not only play it, but display the board in three dimensions, and you can rotate the board. You can do animations. You can create music. Just about anything you might want to do. There are certain limitations that you might not be able to do because it wasn't designed to do everything. That was one of the trade-offs in the design, was to make it the focus on simplicity rather than on complete power.
Well, maybe simplicity is a form of true power. Maybe not complete, but true power.
Well, the way I look at it, what good does it do you to have something that's very powerful and capable if you haven't got a clue as to how to make it work? I'd rather have something less powerful that I can handle. I mean, it might be that a Boeing 757 might be a great plane, but I have no clue how to fly it. But I can take a car and drive it anywhere in the country. So it's not as powerful, but I can use it. I can get somewhere with it.
You know,
if I had an airplane, I'd be sitting there for the rest of my life on the ground.
That's the proverbial story in many ways about Windows, and continues to be certainly with some of the older generation, is that many don't even rise much above the ability to play solitaire with the equipment they have. It's been one of my realizations. People say, well, you know, my computer, you know, it's outdated the day I buy it, and I ask them if it does what they want or can they use it to full capacity. And many times the answer is no.
Well, there's the keeping up with the Joneses scenario. I think every time Microsoft, for example, comes out with a new version of Windows, there's a certain segment of the users that want to jump on the bandwagon because it's the latest and greatest thing. And I, on the other hand, don't look at it that way. I want to know why I should change from something that works and something I know how to use and which works just perfectly well. Why should I jump onto something just because it's new, just because my neighbor says he wants to have it, so I should do it?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing here. It's kind of that keeping up with the Joneses that have pushed us to where we are. I can remember the very early days of CompuServe and AOL and some of those other Internet things long before we had the sophisticated web browsers. And I remember when I first got a CompuServe account, I was – pretty happy with what it did and the ways it worked, maybe because I wasn't forward-thinking, but people kept pushing for more and more artsier, fartsier, glitzier interfaces, and now it has us to the point where we are now, so that I don't know if that's necessarily bad, but on the other hand, I think that it does push people into getting machines that they don't really know how to use. One of the things that I find about the new Windows operating system, maybe you've got some experience with this, and maybe you need to have a tablet. I don't have a tablet. Is what do you think about the newer tablets replacing, you know, being the touch screens replacing the old keyboard desktop systems?
Yeah, well, that's I got a Windows 8 tablet. I have an Acer Iconia. It runs the full Windows, so it's not the RT version that you can't do anything with. The Acer Iconia with the full version of Windows allows you to run simple and create your own software just like you would on a regular PC. I don't like the on-screen keyboard. I mean, I wouldn't want to develop software on a tablet per se. In fact, what I do is I develop the software on my regular computer, and then I put it on a flash drive and plug it into my tablet and download it into there. But trying to type on the screen, that's a god-awful mess.
Well, yeah, I think there's room for both of them. I've got a caller here, Mr. Logic. Let's see what 908 has to say. Name caller?
Oh, yeah, it's Ira.
Yes. What do you have, Ira?
Yeah, I'm into programming, too. You know, I made a website called VernonBohr.com.
Okay.
And it's very good.
You made a website for Vernon?
Yeah.
Well,
it's very good. You should check it out.
Yeah,
I'm a really big fan of the show.
Ira, you sound like a troll for what it's worth, but that's okay. You know, when did you and what did you program it in? Yeah. Troll happens in this medium. They always do that. They hit and miss. You know, for anyone in the chat room, rate the troll for me. I would give him a 2 or 3. I mean, he wasn't very creative because he made he did some of the normal things. As I like the show, I listen to it all the time. I made a website called VernonBohr.com. You would have to reserve and register the domain name.
Looked at VernonBohr.com and there isn't any.
Yeah, oh, I know. So those were the things that went through my mind as I listened to him. The next question I was going to ask him is he hit and ran, you know. Sometimes I play with him and everything. So, yes, people, that was, in fact, a troll. A one-point troll is what they said in the chat room. Because most of them aren't very creative, and most of them have very poor execution, but not always. So, I was going to ask him, how would you do that? You need a domain name. So you have to either have a subdomain to take people to, and then I would never go to a site that someone gave me over the Internet on Blog Talk Radio like that without first checking to see if it was legitimately registered and stuff. That's another thing that happened.
Yeah,
you know, welcome to a very new world, but it's a very powerful world. One of the things about Blog Talk Radio that I found fascinating is they certainly there's a wide breadth of programs that they have on the thing, and this show will be automatically archived for anyone to listen to at a later date. So and it's got a fairly nice interface when you go in and log into the talk show host studio. You know, there's an area for audio clips. There's an area for the callers, for the call board. You can instigate chat, pull up chat, and all that.
Uh-huh.
So how's your Sunday show coming?
Well, I've just started doing it like for the last couple of months. I was kind of off of KSEO for a number of years since I moved up to Northern California. And Michael, the owner, wanted me to come back on again, so I did. And like I said, it's been kind of chaotic at first because my time slot was undefined, really, and they moved me around. And there was one time when they couldn't even get the connection from me to the station. They had to play 2 hours of old-time radio because the equipment had a failure. And there's been, you know, minor problems like that. But I think, cross my fingers, I think most of that's been taken care of now. I know they told me a couple of weeks ago they had to replace a cable because a rat had chewed through it, and that may have been part of the problem. But in the last couple of shows I've done, everything went fairly smoothly, so I think all the problems are pretty much gone.
You know, before we got the troll call, I know what I was going to ask you. There's a variety of different ways to program, but you literally simple is a programming language in and of itself. And so why don't you tell me and my listeners a little bit about that. You know, how do you go about generating a programming language? How does it all start?
Yeah, let me give a plug for my website since we're on the topic. If you want to find out about Simple and you want to download it, and it is free of charge. There's no cost, no obligation, nothing to buy, no viruses, no nothing. It's all just it's there and it's totally what would be the term? Non-invasive, non-intrusive. It's something that, you know, everybody should know how to do. And the website is simply www.simplecodeworks.com, which is kind of a long website. But if you go to Google, just go to Google and search for simple programming. Just type in simple programming in Google, and I believe it's the top item on the list, or if it's not, it's certainly near the top. Now, what is simple?
I actually posted your link in the chat room. I'm glad that you got it out here so that people in archives can go to it. But I got the simplecodeworks.com. The link I gave them was the /website.html.
That's a longer URL. If you just type in simplecodeworks.com, it takes you to the website page.
Cool.
So I didn't want to make it too complicated. It would have been nice to have gotten simple.com, but somebody else already had that a long time ago.
Well, sometimes you win, sometimes you don't. I actually posted your site on my Facebook page in a couple of different places, and one of the comments that I got, someone that went to your simplecodeworks.com was, wow, some of those programs there don't look all that simple.
Well, again, I mean, it's when you... when you teach somebody how to write English and speak English, you say, well, okay, I'm going to teach you how to write stories. Well, you can write a story that goes, look, see spot, run, run, spot, run. Well, that's not very complicated, no. On the other hand, you can write a Tolstoy novel or something and make it very complicated. So it depends on the individual. The language itself is very easy, but that doesn't mean that everything you do has to be trivial.
Sure. Well, actually, you could make an analogy of that to the game of chess. You know, you've got, 64 squares on the board? I can't remember. It's been so long. Is it 8 by 8 or 12 by 12? I can't remember.
8 by 8, yeah.
And, but it's long been a challenging game in terms of, each piece has a certain number of ways it can move, and there are only so many pieces, but you get incredibly complex moves, strategies in terms of the way you put it together. So how do you go about actually, I'll back up. One of the things I've always, one of the reasons I've always thought that it's probably useful for someone to sit down and learn a little bit of programming is to have an appreciation for what it takes to do so. That, when you're looking at the artsy fartsy stuff on your computer screen as you surf the internet and things like that, I think there's a tremendous amount of value in recognizing, for all this glitz, glamour, and the pretty displays on the screen, that there's nothing more than a whole set of instructions going on behind that. And so there's not anything mystical and magical in that respect. So that if you got problems, it gives you kind of a sense, whether you could solve them or not, that they are fixable. Could you comment on that?
Well, programming is not... YouTube movie that Gates and so on made, some of the comments in there were, you don't have to be a genius to write programs. It's not that hard. Whether it is hard or isn't hard depends upon the person who's doing it and what your motivations are. Like you point out, in a chess game, you can play chess at a grade school level, or you can play it at a chess master level. It's the same chess board, same chess pieces, but the level of thinking is different. And the same thing with programming. You can write programs that take you 30 seconds to write, or you can write programs that might take you 30 weeks to write, depending on how complicated the program is going to be. Now, I teach programming to my students up here in Northern California, and I usually start out just by showing them how to draw a circle. So you write a program, you say call circle, give it three numbers, and there's the whole program, one-line program. And the nice thing about simple is you don't have to, unlike languages like C++, you don't have to have all this frivolous declarations of whatever it is they make you require, and curly braces and semicolons and all that stuff. You can just get right in and say draw a circle, and that's it, one line. So in that sense, programming is very trivial. On the other hand, if you're going to write a program that's going to do complex recursions and things that are very complicated, then it's going to be a little bit more work.
Well, one of the things that struck me philosophically about programming that I'm going to love to hear your input on this. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but you know, as you always, as I've always heard you say, is that you know, if you can program the machine, the computer, whatever, you can get it to do what you want. And clearly, there's tons of software, tons of stuff out there that one can find without having to program that will frequently do what you want. But the thing that I came up with that really struck me is if you have no sense of what it takes to program, and it's always someone else programming, in a way, the programmers determine and channel your thinking in the direction of your thinking, because you think within the box of the tools you're given to work with. And if nothing else, knowing that you could program your computer to do something that you wanted it to do in the event that you couldn't find a program that already did it. I've always thought that was kind of an interesting concept.
Yeah, well, being able to make it do something new and original is certainly a fun thing. But to me, I mean, going back to, I guess, back to the beginning question, you know, how did I get into programming? The reason I do it is because it's fun. It's a hobby. The analogy I sometimes draw is to karaoke. Now, you go to bars or someplace, and they got a karaoke disc jockey there, and everybody gets up, and they start singing these words that appear on the monitor, and the music is playing. And it's kind of a similar concept. Why would somebody want to go and watch some amateur get on a stage and read words off of a TV screen while music is playing in the background? It seems to me you'd be better spent your time going out and getting a professional recording, you know, from a famous movie star or singer, and listen to that person sing rather than doing it yourself. Well, why would you want to do it yourself? Because it's fun. I mean, it's not so much fun. It may be nice entertainment to listen to a professional singer, but when you do it yourself, now you're having some real fun. And the same thing with programming. You can go out and buy programs from somebody else who made them, a professional programmer. But to me, the fun is doing it yourself and seeing your own creation come to life on the screen.
Well, that's a very profound thing, to see your own creation come to life. I know certainly in the programming I've done, the things I've written, very simple things way back then. I know there's a tremendous sense of accomplishment when you do write a program. You get it totally debugged, you get it to work and do everything you want, as well as give you the right answers, the answers it should. I've written programs that ran, didn't have any errors or bugs in them, but didn't give me the right calculations. That is certainly a sense of accomplishment, you know, certainly a sense of accomplishment to deal with.
Well, that actually happens with some of my students. They set out with this idea. They're going to write a program that's going to draw, you know, 50 circles, and they're all going to be different colors, and they're all going to do this, and they're all going to do that. And they run the program, and they don't get what they expected, but what they got was probably even better than they hoped for. You sometimes get surprised. The computer will do something you didn't anticipate, and it looks better than what you wanted.
Let me jump in. People that don't know you would also not know that you wrote a very interesting book called Fuzzy Logic, Shades of Reality, dealing with fuzzy logic. And it's on your website. Could you comment, are you doing any more writing these days?
Not of books. I mean, I'm doing a lot of writing of websites and stuff and updating documentation. I mean, the Simple has a complete tutorial, a 9-part tutorial on the website, which I wrote. Probably doesn't count as a book in the traditional sense, but if it were printed out, it would certainly be a book. So I'm still writing in terms of internet material. I'm not writing publications on paper so much.
I thought that your book was outstanding. You know, Shades of Reality. That was well written, and it gets into the realm that people frequently don't think about. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about Shades of Reality? Because I think in a lot of respects, is we don't hear very much about fuzzy logic these days. I don't know how many people have thought about it.
Yeah, I'm surprised they don't know it. Me too. I mean, it seems like everybody should know it by now, but it took as long as it did to even happen. Yeah, I started doing my show at KSCO, like back in the 1990s, and I had come up independently on my own with a philosophy of looking at reality. And I talked about it on my show, you know, quite a few times. And one day, one of my listeners called in and said, "Hey, what you're talking about is something called fuzzy logic." Well, I hadn't heard much about fuzzy logic either, so I looked into it, and I found some papers and stuff. And as I read those papers, it was almost like I had written them. They were saying the very same thing I was saying. Only my approach was slightly different in that mine wasn't a mathematical approach as much as theirs was. Mine was an approach to the philosophical realities of the universe, of the world. Whereas, see, fuzzy logic, for those who don't know it, is actually a mathematical concept. It was, I can't say there was one person who created it, but Professor Lotfi Zada at the University of California, Berkeley, is probably the first person to actually call it fuzzy logic. But the concepts have been evolving for hundreds of years. And it started with Aristotle, but it was based on Aristotle's thinking. Not in the sense that Aristotle thought in terms of fuzzy logic, quite the opposite. Fuzzy logic and Aristotle were at complete opposites. And that's how fuzzy logic began, in that it was a refutation of Aristotle's philosophy that something is either A or it isn't. It's either yes or it's no. And fuzzy logic allows for in-between states. Something can be partly yes and partly no at the same time. A concept which is kind of revolutionary in terms of crisp set theory, the Cantor-type set theory. I don't know how much you want to get technical on this.
No, keep going. Let's see what we got here. There's a caller. See, 630, you're on. Another troll. That's okay. He's listening to some sitar music, it sounds like. So, talk about that, you know, because many of the problems that we face sociologically are of the fuzzy logic genres, as you've said many, many times, you know. There's much that isn't either-or thinking, and Aristotelian thinking is an either-or prospect. And in the Western world, we're really drawn into that.
Well, I mean, when you say there's much that isn't, you know, yes or no, it goes more than that. It's like I can't think of anything that isn't fuzzy. And it's not that some things are fuzzy. It's like all of reality is fuzzy. There's almost nothing except for mathematics, and that's not really a part of reality. That's a mental concept in itself. But anything in physical reality is all fuzzy.
Go on, I'm listening.
Well, for example,
I want you to distinguish that, too, for the listening audience. Fuzzy logic, as you always used to say, a lot of people think that when you're talking about fuzzy logic, you're talking about fuzzy thinking, and that's not what he's talking about at all. There's a big difference between fuzzy thinking, because there's a lot of fuzzy and fuzzy-headed thinking that goes on in the world, and that's very different from fuzzy logic. They are the two things that are definitely distinct, and I don't know if you could even say there's a relationship between the two.
The term fuzzy, unfortunately, is a bad term. I didn't invent the term, but whoever did probably couldn't think of a better one at the time. I would have preferred something like, as I think about it now, even the terms I'm coming up with are somewhat misleading too. Like you said, fuzzy logic sounds like fuzzy thinking or muddled thinking or unclear thinking or confusion or something like that. No, fuzzy logic is not confused or muddled. Quite the opposite. Fuzzy logic is very clear thinking. It's very precise thinking, much more so than regular thinking where you simply simplify things down to yes or no. One of the questions or a thought experiment you might do is take somebody to top of a mountain someplace where you have a nice clear view of the sky, And you sit there down on a rock, and you ask the person, is it daytime or is it nighttime? Pick one or the other. And the sun's shining, so he says, well, it's daytime. So you wait 10 seconds and ask the question again. Well, of course, it's still daytime. Well, you keep asking it over and over. Somewhere he's going to have to change his answer from daytime to nighttime. And it'll be interesting to see how you decide when day suddenly turns into night. There isn't any point where it suddenly turns. And yet here we have two completely different categories, one called daytime, which brings to mind the image of the sun shining, and the other one is nighttime, which brings to mind the image of stars in the sky. Now, when does one change into the other? Now, if you were Aristotle, he'd be hard-pressed to come up with an answer because he couldn't come up with anything in between yes or no.
But what fuzzy logic would tell you, there's a space of time in there where going from day to night is occurring, I would say.
Well, it's not just a space of time. It's all time. At any time in the day, it can be thought of as being nighttime to some degree and daytime to some degree. Now, maybe the degree is going to be zero, but it's still going to be a degree. Let's say at noon, the answer to the question is a daytime, yes or no, would be 100% yes and 0% no. As you get around 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, the question might have like an 80% yes and a 20% no. And as you get into the dusk, it's like 50%, 50%. And when you're looking at the last twilight, it's probably 90% dark and 10% day. So there's no point at which it suddenly changes from one to the other. It just gradually evolves into the other one.
Is there anything in which, clearly in your book, Shades of Reality, you talk about all reality, and you're even speaking right now that fundamentally all reality is fuzzy to some extent, or fuzzy, period. Maybe that's Aristotelian the way I phrased that, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's aside from semantics of how you're saying, all of reality is essentially fuzzy, but then fuzzy, that's not a contradictory statement of saying all or nothing, because by saying all, I'm allowing for 0 and 100 as the two extreme possibilities as well. So therefore,
you know,
everything is included.
To my listening audience, I have to tell you that Mr. Logic drove many a person, and by the way, it's not him that's determined that that's what we're talking about right now. It was me that brought up the subject. But the number of people that used to go nuts with you and go round and round and round about this is phenomenal. They just couldn't wrap their heads around it. They always wanted you to come to some sort of Aristotelian comment on the fuzziness of fuzzy logic.
Well, fuzzy logic is just reality. That's what it comes down to. And it's what makes it non-reality is that, or what's ironic is that when somebody talks about being real or having reality, most of the time they're talking about non-reality. You go to a bar, what kind of conversations do you hear? Oh, the football team that so-and-so, this guy ran out of bounds and the referee threw a penalty flag. And blah. It's all these Aristotelian things that don't have anything to do with reality. A football game, for example, is not real. It's all a mental game being played in the mind. You have physical things going on in the world, but the fact he stepped out across a boundary line doesn't really mean anything other than the fact that the game says the rules, you're not allowed to do that, or else the penalty flag throws or something. It's all non-reality. It's all mental. Reality itself doesn't play those kinds of games.
What kind of games? If reality doesn't play those kinds of games, what is reality? Would gravity be reality?
Is what reality?
Gravity.
Yeah. I mean, the physical laws of the universe are real. The laws of man are not real. I mean, for example, you go from California to Nevada, you cross the state line. Well, is there actually a line there in reality? No, it's a game made up by our legal system. Somebody says, we're going to pretend there's a line there. There isn't a line. There's no reality line other than in the fact we imagine it.
That part is true, and most of the examples that you can give, I totally agree with that. The question that comes up for me is, I read Shades of Reality. You give some very interesting examples there. So if you have 10 marbles, 5 black and 5 white, and someone tells you to sort the marbles by color, it becomes very clear which one goes where. So it seems to me that even within fuzzy logic, you have to have some provision for some absolutes, and I can't tell you particularly what they are. It's much like Schrodinger's cat. Is people always say the cat simultaneously alive and dead in the box. Well, that's an artificial construct, in my opinion, too, is that the cat is alive or dead in the box, depending on it. Those are constructs that people wrote up to describe the physical quantum mechanical states, and the cat didn't wait there to be in a certain state to be dead or alive.
It's like quantum entanglement. You have a positron and an electron, and you separate them, but you don't know what the spins of each one is. But you go and measure one, and that independently makes the other one known. I mean, so you might say, was it known all along? Or do we just have to measure the one and suddenly it became known? I mean,
yeah, but if you measure the other one, then it determines the spin of the second one. And there are some things that will define maybe our ability to understand. Maybe what it is just an incomplete knowledge of the universe.
Of course, our knowledge of the universe is incomplete. There's no doubt about that. If it were, there would be no science, because we know everything. Science is the study of reality. That's one of the things I mentioned in my book. So by the fact that science is still around means there are aspects of reality that need to be yet determined, and that we see happening all the time when we read science news. You know, somebody will find, like last week, they found some goldfish in Lake Tahoe that were like 2 feet long or something. So there's new discoveries occurring all the time. We certainly don't know everything in science.
No, absolutely. That's one of the things that fascinates me, is because people seem to have made science this, religion after the, more or less in this day and age. And having worked in science, my underlying presupposition and premise is that science is necessarily always a partial answer, partially wrong or incomplete because of its nature, as we try and explore, discover what is true about the universe we know, and as our measuring equipment gets better, as our knowledge gets better, the answers that were correct yesterday are no longer the correct answers today.
Hey, Vernon, I want to try something here, just not to change the subject.
Sure.
Just a little experiment. Tomorrow I'm going to be doing my show on KSCO, and I prepared some puzzle questions that I was going to give. I thought I might toss one of them out here, just to see if anybody is listening can figure it out.
Okay.
It's a very simple question. You know the letters of the alphabet. There's 26 of them, A through Z. You know the states in the United States. There's 50 of them. Which one letter of the alphabet does not appear anywhere in the names of any of the U.S. states?
26 letters in the alphabet, 50 states, and you want to know which letter does not appear in at all?
Yeah, at all. I mean, obviously, you know, A's got Alabama and California. They all have A's in them. But what would be the only letter that doesn't appear? And if anybody would like to call in, we'd like to hear from you and see how long it takes someone to figure it out and then call in. It's about 4:53, going on 4:54 now. Be kind of fun to see how long it takes someone to find the one and only letter that doesn't appear in any state's
name.
Well,
someone's already given me an answer in chat here.
And what did they say?
The letter Z is in zebra.
Well, how about Arizona?
How about Arizona, folks? See, now listen, you're supposed to be, how about, the second one that came up was X.
How about Texas?
How about Texas? So
not as easy as it sounded, hey?
No, you know, you guys are doing a fish in the barrel shoot, a crap shoot, and guessing. You know what? Let me throw something out here. It's actually quite fascinating and ties into this. I'll send you some links to some stuff you might find interesting about it. Is there's been a lot of work done on thinking, and there's a book that came out called Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow, and it distinguishes. Okay, we got another guest here. Q.
You have a guess? What was it, Q?
Yes.
Well, it took about 2 minutes, but that's the right answer, yes.
Thule got the prize. It took 2 minutes to get the right one. Now, did you just guess, Thule? So Q is the only letter that doesn't exist. Anyway, what the whole thing talks about, it does an Aristotelian approach of human thinking, only for ease of explanation, it distinguishes between fast thinking and slow thinking. The fast thinking being the gut level emotional thinking, which there's an automaticity to it. You know, most of the first answers were like that, but the things that pop up automatically versus the ones that in fact challenge the mind and that you literally have to sit down and think come up with answers for is the example is 2 + 2 is kind of an automatic thought. Most of our minds, 4, 2 + 2, 4. We remember those times tables. But if someone was to ask most of us, you know, what is the product of 17 × 354? We'd have to kind of, you know, grind it through our wheels unless we were, you know, we had learned some mnemonic for doing that. And
rather
I was
than
just
calling it fast and slow thinking, I would probably generalize it into analytical thinking versus impulsive thinking. Things that just come to mind aren't things you really think about. They're just impressions that occur. Whereas analytical thinking is, let's see, if I multiply 32 times 71, I got to carry the 2, multiply, but, you know, that kind of thinking where you have to go through steps of conscious analysis. That's a different kind of thinking than just having an impulse that hits you.
Have you ever given out the puzzle, the Einstein's Who Owns the Fish? Einstein's Who Owns?
I don't remember that one.
I have to look up. There are fundamentally 5 people of 5 nationalities. They live in 5 different houses. They all drink.
Those kinds of. Yeah, I've seen similar puzzles, not necessarily Who Owns the Fish. Yeah, there's different professions, live in different colored houses, have different names of wives, and so on. And then, you know, the guy in the blue house is not the postman, and yada, yada, and you're supposed to piece together who's who and where they live, and so on. Yeah, there's a number of those kinds.
Yeah, there are 5 houses in a row and 5 different colors, and each house lives a person of a different country. Each person drinks a certain drink, plays a certain sport, and keeps a certain pet. No 2 people drink the same drink, play the same sport, or keep the same pet. And then it gives you a list of clues along the way, and it says who owns the fish. I was surprised it had commented at the bottom is that Einstein claimed that 90% of the world could not work it out.
Well, that's probably true. Of course, for the computer, it makes it a lot easier because you can essentially write a program that
I was going to say that with simple, if you wrote the right program, it could whip through it. Might take you longer to write the programs than to work it through on your own, though.
Yeah, writing a program generally takes you longer than that's a good point. That if you're in a hurry to get an answer and it's something you can do without a computer, you're probably better off doing it without a computer because it can take quite a while to make a program to do something. That's why we generally write programs that are going to be used over and over again for different data rather than just one application.
Yeah, one of my good friends from years and years ago, we used to have those conversations, is that when it comes down to technology, you can get to a stage of inverse technology where it takes you twice as long to do something with technology than it would take you to do it just, you know, off the spur of the moment. And the beauty of technology, clearly, is if you want to do the same repetitive problem over and over, the same type of thing over and over, a program certainly makes that easy. But, there's, you know, people spend, you know, 15 minutes trying to get their iPhone, to pull up the app, to get in the telephone number and stuff, where they could write the whole damn thing down on a sheet of paper in like 30 seconds. And that would fulfill the same function.
Do you have to break for news at the top of the hour or anything like that?
I have no restrictions. I can even say nasty words like fuck this, you know, to hell with that. You know, there's no restrictions.
Oh,
this
yeah, you
not...
asked me if I was ever on internet. Yes, I was, but Michael's whirling. Because years ago we had something on the internet, and he says, yeah, there's no restrictions. You can use words like fuck and everything. And I remember now, yeah, because we did that.
It's amazing what can jog your memory, eh? A little four-letter word. Can't be said on terrestrial radio and stuff. Oh, it's come a long ways. Apparently Blog Talk Radio really started to take off in 2008. So in that respect, I'm a relatively latecomer. I'm kind of a newbie on the block, but I certainly have enjoyed it in the period of time I've been doing it. There's a side, well, the trolls can be fun too. You know, there are times that will go round and round. The problem with trolls is they're just so uncreative in most cases. Yeah. You know, that and there's a tremendous possibility for the technology that I've enjoyed about doing internet radio, and that is the ability to have dialogues like this, dialogues with someone like you. And on a good night, I can, in theory, have up to 50 people on the line on my account. The most I've ever had call in at once has been 7 or 8. But you can get some really interesting dialogues going, things that you can't really do on, I guess you've got the multiple lines coming into the studio. But on terrestrial radio, everything's a lot more tightly regulated.
You've been doing this for about a year, you said?
Yeah, I did my first show, actually, it was a little over a year. I did my first show in November. I did a couple shows at the end of 2011 and then pretty much jumped into it heavily in 2012. I do 3 shows a week. I do this show, and I'll do one tonight and one tomorrow night as well.
I'm glad to see that you pronounced the names of the years correctly. Everybody else seems to like to call it 2000 something or other. And I point out that's totally inconsistent because, you know, 20 years ago you didn't call it 1900 whatever. You called it 19 so and so. And so now it's 20 so and so. We won't get to 2000 so and so for thousands of years yet.
Well, see, still, even though I pronounce them correctly, that's kind of an automaticity. Just something in me, I didn't even think about how I pronounce those, you know. So, but, you know, as you would tell people that were listening to your other show, is counting really starts at 0 and not at 1.
That's right.
Huh?
That's why there's that confusion about whether noon is AM or PM.
Well, there's a lot of confusion in the human realm of communication. In that particular respect, I think there's a lot to be learned from computers. It's a delicate balance. There are conversations that are just of the football nature, you know, who won, who got across the line, do you watch this and that, a lot of what some people call trivial conversation. But there's also more substantive conversation that I'll always wonder about when I think about texting, because I always think, how would people carry on philosophical dialogues in 140 character tweets.
In what kind?
140 character tweets is on Twitter.
I don't tweet, so I'm totally odd on Facebook and tweeting and all that other nonsense. I'm probably the only person in the world who doesn't use a computer for any of that stuff.
Well, you know, it's kind of fun. One of the things that I was thinking when I was thinking about it, simple, as you told people, you know, with one line of code, you know, you can have the program draw a circle. And what I thought, what came to mind is, in terms of the programming language, you did a lot of the work in the functions that run the language to save people a lot of work in terms of doing their own programming later if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, that's basically the idea behind the philosophy behind Simple is modularity, and that what you do is you create a library or what would you call it, a storehouse of capability, whatever terminology you want to use. In Simple, we call it a library, and the library contains modules. And the module can do something as trivial as draw a circle or draw a triangle or make an explosion on the screen or draw a rocket. Each one of those, it represents a module or an inherent capability. And so programming, when you get to that level, now it simply becomes a matter of piecing together, almost like a Lego construction kit. You take an explosion module, you hook it to a rocket module, and you make the rocket explode. So I put all that work in so that nobody else has to do it.
No, that's what I was just thinking. Is simple is kind of your Lego kit of programming. I will download it since this is whatever revision and take a look at it. I have not written any apps, but now you've gotten me excited again. I can think of some apps that could be useful and fun to write. Maybe even apps for fun and profit.
Well, I have one app that probably my most popular, if you want to call it an app. It's a program, almost trivial program. It takes 5 minutes to write the program. That I've written it, but whenever I teach programming in the schools, that's the one program the kids always seem to be fascinated with, and that's my KaleidoDraw program. And what it does is you take your mouse. It's basically an Etch-A-Sketch. You know, if you take an Etch-A-Sketch, you move your mouse, and it follows, draws a colored line wherever your mouse is. And all you do is you reflect that image, make mirror copies, left, right, horizontal, vertical, so you end up with a kaleidoscope. And so you use your mouse to draw a colored kaleidoscope picture. And all the girls really seem to like that. It's artistically creative, I guess they must think.
So someone can download the thing right now and start drawing on their screen. I'm going to put it in the chat room. I got it up here.
Yeah, in fact, you can download the KaleidoDraw program without even downloading Simple. If you just want to draw on your screen, just go to the Simple CodeWorks homepage, or actually the website, I guess you call it, website.html. And somewhere about halfway down on the page, there's something you can click that will let you download the program, and you can actually just run it on your computer.
Yeah, I just did that. I haven't run it yet. It's going to tell me, do I want to let this unknown executable run? Okay. Folks, this gives a whole new meaning to Blog Talk Radio. What do I do? Just reload the screen to refresh it or escape?
Out of the program, you hit the escape key, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people wouldn't know to hit the escape. That's been a long, or control C used to be another one that people used to use all the time. That's kind of cool. I need to look at the code.
Yeah, well, the code is actually part of the download because the source listing is part of Simple when you get it. But I don't remember if I put code up on the website to look at it because I figure at that point nobody's interested really unless you want to do programming.
Oh, no, it says if you're interested in seeing the source listing for KaleidoDraw program, click here.
Oh, it is. And, okay, I wasn't sure.
Yeah. In fact, let's see if this will all fit. That's not very many lines of code.
No, I told you it took me about 5 minutes to write.
Let's see.
That's an example of the kinds of things that you can do once you have a programming language. Now, you probably wouldn't want to go out and look for a kaleidoscope program per se, but when you make one yourself, then it takes on a whole new meaning. It's not just like you went out and got an app from somebody else. It's your own app that nobody in the world has but you if you made it.
No, I know. It's like we live at a point in time. I wonder how many people would have the patience. Well, you clearly teach courses. I'm kind of thinking and talking at the same time because we live in a time where people are so used to stuff being written and done for them, they don't have a lot of patience with their computers. They have become I don't know what to call them entertainment devices for
yeah, I know,
what I call,
exactly. That's the problem I run in teaching some of the kids. You have to get kids, there's a two-pronged problem here. We're in the wrong time frame, and you have to be in the right age frame of the student. If kids are only 2 or 3 years old, they're obviously not old enough to even understand the concepts. And if they're too old, then they're more interested in going out with girls and stuff like that, and they're not going to be paying attention to computers either. So you got to get kids that are just the right age, probably, you know, like around fifth or sixth grade. And then the problem with that is kids, I'll have a kid come into the class and he wants to know what we're doing. And I'll say, well, do you know how to use a computer? He says, oh, yeah, I know how to use a computer. So I say, oh, good. Well, here, sit down. Let's try something. It turns out they don't even know how to type on a keyboard. They can't even find the letters on the keyboard. Where's the parenthesis? Where's the minus sign? They can't even find them. And worse yet, they can't even spell. Circle, S-I-R-K-E-L. Color, K-O-L-E-R. How are you going to have them write a program if they can't even spell the words properly?
Well, you know, one of the things I could say is that you might not be able to spell words properly, but if you learn the language and the code for the various functions, you know, ARC or something for art, or CIR for circle, you might be able to circumvent that. So I don't want to get too hard and heavy on that. But I understand what you're saying. We live in a society, too, where is the automatic answer is, well, what can you do with it? What am I going to do? What would I want that for? And as you answered earlier, two things. First of all, entertainment. You write programs for fun and challenges. It certainly is possible when someone wants to go further. People do take programming experience and go out in the real world and do write games, which there's big money in. But I'm kind of fascinated by the low attention span we have in our society for much anything that's not already spelled out to, you know, and
well, that's what I was getting at. I mean, these kids who think they know all about computers spend so much time playing games. And it has a twofold negative attribute in that it makes them think they know how computers and how they work and how to use them, when actually all they know how to do is push a mouse around. And secondly, it's gotten them spoiled to the extent that everything is being spoon-fed. They want a game, they just go out and, you know, the game is there. And when they want to take my class, and I say, well, what do you plan to do with programming? Well, I want to make a game. That's almost universal response. They all want to make a game. And I say, oh, fine, what kind of game do you want to make? And they've got these grandiose ideas, but they don't have a clue as to how to even begin to do it. And it's kind of hard to explain to them that it isn't that trivial.
That fascinates me too, because not that anyone should be a certain way, but like I say, the attention spans are. That's why I made the comment about apps earlier. It's not so much that I would want to run out and write an app for my cell phone, although I've got an old cell phone that I don't really use any apps on. But I'm intrigued by the fact that the extent that you can't program or do it yourself, whether you want to or not, you're limited to what someone else decides you need. And that's one of the things that you all have always said about programming, is if you know how to program, if you know the background behind programming, if you kind of know what it entails and encompasses, then you're not limited to someone else's thinking for what you get as your entertainment or your tools.
Yeah, I'll occasionally run a program, or I'll be using, you know, some piece of software that's part of Windows or whatever, and they'll do something, and if I weren't a programmer, I would just accept it as saying, well, that's the way it has to be. But knowing better, I start questioning, well, why did they do it that way? They could have just as easily done so-and-so, and I know they could have done so-and-so because I do those kinds of things, and yet I have to put up with some of these dumb designs, and I can't do anything about it because I don't have the source listings.
And you know, in today's, I'll back up. Do you do much script writing?
What do you mean by script writing?
PHP, JavaScript, any of that stuff?
Yeah, I've done some JavaScript. In fact, I have a game on the website. I think it's called Escape, which is part of the Mr. Logic game series, and it's basically all JavaScript. It has animations and stuff in there. I haven't done any JavaScript lately. I mean, I've kind of been spending most of my time with Simple, but maybe 5 or 10 years ago, I did quite a bit of JavaScript.
You know, one of the other things that interests and fascinates me too, though, about, you know, the low attention span, you know, it gets into the realm of our news reporting, if you will, these days, and it even gets into things like the climate science and everything. And I don't know that I particularly want to go there for any particular reason. But one of the things about, if you can think, what seems to be missing in this culture, in many respects, is people thinking through what's put out there is fact and truth, and that I find that one troubling as well. You know, when you there's
I guess I missed something there.
I'm thinking about some of the global warming and climate change stuff that people throw out, and no one searches out further. They take whatever the headline says, and they don't think about the implication of what it said. I'll give you a very simple example. You know, the press and news media is very good at using adjectives to express things. So that from a scientific standpoint, when I read something that says hottest year on record or even coldest year on record, it really has very little weight to me because that tells me virtually nothing. That actually falls in the realm of fuzzy logic, if you will. Because hottest, hottest only means that it's warmer than the previous hottest, and it doesn't tell you anything about how much. But it evokes visceral feelings of people, and it drives me nuts that we don't say, well, wait a second, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, that just happened actually about a week ago or so. You've heard of, obviously, asteroid 2012 DA14, the one that came, it was advertised in the news as the closest asteroid in history to ever approach the Earth. Now, what they didn't read, that was the headline, but when you read the article, it turns out the closest one in history, the history is only about 15 years old. I mean, they didn't measure asteroids prior to that. So in the last 15 years, it's the closest one to approach the Earth, but the headline makes it sound like it's the closest one for thousands of years.
Yeah, throughout the beginning of time. But we have that kind of thinking. It's almost knee-jerk in this day and age because the headlines are bigger than norm, bigger than life, and they just seem to hook us and evoke all manner of nonsense response to us. And I find that interesting. What I find interesting, too, is even as they work on earthquake predictions, because you and I live in earthquake country in California, I've given that a lot of thought. Part of me wonder if you know when the earthquake's going to hit to a T, maybe you can batten down the hatches. But how far in advance does it make a big difference? How much warning do you need for it to make a huge difference?
Well, it depends upon, circumstances. I mean, if you only know a matter of seconds before, that's not much you're going to be able to do. If you know minutes before, well, you can get out of a building if you're in a dangerous building. If you could know years in advance, well, that would, make your long-term planning be something that you'd be doing differently.
Sure, if you know you're going to have one, if you absolutely know that you're going to have one within the next 3 years.
Well, if you know you're going to have one, I wouldn't be building a house on a fault zone.
We might move back. Well, actually, I guess New York has been had some earthquakes recently. They don't get a lot of them. A lot of people don't realize that New York's have earthquakes and everything too. Okay, do you have another puzzle for the group here? Was that your only shot for tomorrow?
Oh, I've got a couple of them. Unfortunately, they require. I don't have my notes with me. I just happen to remember the other one offhand.
Okay, I have a pretty hot crowd here. They came up and you said 2 minutes. That's not bad.
There's also the old standby. There's a couple old standbys. The one where you have three boxes up on a shelf, high up, and you can't see inside the boxes, and each box contains 100 marbles. One of the boxes has 100 black marbles. One of the other boxes has 100 white marbles. And the remaining box has a mixture of 50 black marbles and 50 white marbles. Each box has a label on it. One box is labeled black marbles. Another box is labeled white marbles. And the last box is labeled mixture. Each box has the wrong label. The question is, how many marbles must you take out of which box or boxes and look at so that you can then correctly put the label on each box?
I'm trying to make sure I get it right here in the chat room. So I got three boxes on a shelf. 100 black marbles, 100 white marbles, and one box, 50 white, 50 black.
Yeah, and you can't see inside the box except by reaching in and pulling out a marble or two or whatever you want and then looking at the marble.
And they're all mislabeled.
Every box has the wrong label.
So you could actually say it another way, is you have labels that go on the boxes, but you don't know which box they go on.
No, that's not the same problem.
Okay.
It sounds
okay.
Like it might be the same, but it's actually not.
I got it. Okay.
And so, see, if I were doing this on KSCO, I'd say, hey, if you know the answer, call us here at 479-1080. And
well, you know, you can say it right now on Blog Talk Radio. Write your answer down in chat, and we'll tell you if it's right or not. Don from Salinas, welcome to BTR here with Vernon on his Santa Cruz run with Mr. Logic.
Hi, Vernon.
How are you doing?
Oh, doing great. You got a good guess there, Mr. Logic. The answer is three marbles.
Which three marbles would you take?
No, three marbles from each box if you want to make sure.
Three from each box.
Yeah.
Okay, how would that be able to let you put the correct labels on?
Okay, if you have a mixture of black and white marbles, you take three marbles from the box.
And which one is the box? Which one is the box with the black and white marbles?
The one with the black, well, that's why you pick three marbles from each box.
Okay, so you pick three marbles, and if you get all three of them.
And if you've got a mixture, if you've got a black marble, if you've got two black marbles, one white marble, you know it's the mixed box.
Right.
If you've got three black marbles, it's the black box. If you've got three white marbles, it's the white box.
No, three white marbles might have all come from the same mixture.
It's pretty much a guarantee that you're not going to get all of the same color.
No, there's no probability involved. This is doesn't depend on luck or anything. There's a well-defined way of doing it.
When I was taught as a kid, there was if you were in a closet and you had black socks and white socks and the light was off, how many socks would you have to pick up to make sure you had a pair?
Yeah, you take out three. But that's a different problem.
Well, then you got me stumped.
So
this one takes a little bit of thinking.
What is the minimum number of marbles you have to pull out of each box in order to know?
What's the total number of marbles? But first, let's look at it first of all. How many marbles must you look at, regardless of where they come from? And then secondly, I guess, would be how many of those marbles come from which box?
Oh, okay. That doesn't sound doesn't make much sense to me. So you're above my head.
No, it's just, you know, you just want to put the right labels on the boxes, and you want to do so by pulling out as few marbles as you have to. And you don't want to assume you're going to be lucky and hope that you're going to get one black.
You don't
want to
be like the people that were answering the letter program, the letter in the state's names. You don't want to be guessing. You get one shot to do it right. Otherwise, you get shot.
Well, I'll stick with pick three marbles out of each box, and you're
pretty
much. So
that'd be a total of nine marbles, you say?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, your answer isn't right, but now I could give the answer and ask you how you would solve it, given that answer.
Don't give it yet. I want to see if anyone out there, you know, in the listening audience comes up with something.
Okay.
Yeah. My only other answer would be get a stepladder.
No peeking, no cheating.
So, you know, it is possible. There's no restrictions on what boxes you go. If you decide to stick and keep pulling all the marbles out of one box, that wouldn't give you the answer, but you could do it that way.
Yeah, if you took all the marbles out, you know, so you take out 300 marbles, that would certainly tell you the right answer, but you can do it with less than that.
But there's no restrictions on which box you pull them from or how you do it. Just what's the minimum number of marbles you have to pull out.
From which box
to uniquely define the answer.
Right.
Okay, you guys, I have a challenge for you out there in the chat room.
How about this? 6 marbles, 3 from one box, 3 from another box. There you go.
3 from which box?
Any box. Any of 2 boxes. 3 from 2 of the boxes.
Okay,
three
let's
marbles
see you do
out of
that.
I pull out
3 marbles from one of the boxes and they're all white. I go to another box, I pull out 3 marbles and they're all white. What is that going to tell me?
Yeah, that's going to tell you that you're not very lucky, or you are.
Well, this isn't a question of luck. This is a deterministic way of finding the answer.
Okay, let's say 4 marbles from 2 of the boxes. 4 marbles each from 2 boxes.
How is that going to be any better?
Well, you've got 50-50 chance in the mixture of white and black.
Yeah.
So if you double it, make it 4, then you're almost at 100% chance you're going to get...
See, you're almost. This isn't an almost thing. This is a very precise, definite thing. It's not like you're playing the odds.
Okay,
there's no probability.
Hopefully somebody else will call. I was going to say 5 marbles each from 2 boxes.
No, that's not right either.
Oh, can I ask you a question while we're waiting? Maybe somebody will come up with the right answer.
Okay.
I'm about Vernon's age, and I came from the time, like when I was a kid, I had a Timex Sinclair. And I remember the thrill that I felt when I first saw a personal computer. I think it was an Altair. I can't remember. But
an Altair? Yeah, those are back in the 70s.
It untied you from the mainframe. It used to be to do any kind of computing, you just were at a terminal, and you were at the mercy of the nerds in the basement with the mainframe. You know, you have to ask them permission and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well, when we got personal computers, everyone was so elated. We're independent. We can do what we want. Doesn't it look like everyone's going back to the mainframe?
Not really, no. I mean, why would you say that?
Well, because they're not storing programs on their computers anymore. They're using someone else's programs out there in the cloud, which to me is just a fancy name for the mainframe.
Well, you're talking about the internet now rather than computing. See, I think of computing as something independent of online. Online is an application of computing. But it's not. When I think of computing, I think of something that has nothing to do with the internet.
Well, people are doing their computing online. They're using their word processor programs. They're using their spreadsheet programs. They're doing pretty much everything and storing all their information somewhere else.
Well, that's their choice. I mean, that has nothing to do with writing. You know, doing the software or the algorithms involved. I mean, that's just a matter of where you're going to store your data, whether you store it in a cookie jar or whether you store it on the cloud or whether you store it on a flash drive. I mean, that's a separate issue. It's not that the computer...
But what happened to people being jealous of their stuff? It seems like, you know, if you put it somewhere else, it's in somebody else's pocket, and if something happens on their end, it's gone.
Well, I back up everything on flash drives. I mean,
uh-huh.
I have everything I want to save. I don't put it on the cloud. I don't put it on a website. I put everything locally, so I have it in my grimy little hands, and I can do what I want with it.
Yeah. But it doesn't seem like the trend is going away from that now.
Well, see, I don't know about trends. I'm not a trend follower. I rather set trends.
I'm kind of with you. I try to keep all my information to myself as possible with as little of it going out as I can.
Yeah.
It seems to me like when it gets out there, people's information and stuff is being manipulated in so many ways it's not even funny.
Well, that's why I don't put things out there that I don't want to go out there. I mean, I'll upload things to my website because they're intended to be seen, but things I want for myself, I keep here.
And another question I have for you, you were making the comment about how a lot of kids can't spell nowadays.
They're pretty bad at spelling, yeah.
Well, they're depending on the spell checker, instead of actually looking at the word themselves, they're just typing blah, 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 and then they spell check. Well, to me, it looks to me like 10 years from now, if some genius figured out a virus that could go into the spell checkers and make circle S-E-A-R-K-L-E, would anybody notice?
I guess they'd notice if somebody made a mistake and typed it and it didn't catch it. They'd say, hey, wait a minute, what's wrong with this spell checker?
Well, if they knew how to spell circle.
Well, I actually thought of designing into my simple language all the popular misspellings for words so that when kids write programs, if they don't spell the words right, if it fell into one of my lists, like let's say circle, I would allow C-I-R-C-L-E, S-I-R-K-E-L, every possible spelling for circle that I could think of. And then when kids spelled it wrong, it would just go right through and there'd be no problem.
Yeah. And, some of this texting, writing stuff looks to me like, it reminds me very much of when I would read letters of the Civil War times and of the Frontier times, kilt a bar, K-I-L-T-A-B-A-R, they would write those kinds of things because people were very much illiterate back then and wrote the way they spoke. And it looks like they're kind of doing that.
Yeah, in ancient times, I mean, you look at some of, not just Civil War, but going back to, ancient England, their spellings of even, very similar type things. They spell them somewhat phonetically. I'm trying to think of an example offhand, but I can't think of one right now. But I just remember seeing one actually a few days ago. Somebody was looking at some ancient document, and it was almost illegible because the words were all spelled wrong. But languages change.
Yeah, well, is language changing now? Is our language changing now in the spelling and the meaning of the words and such?
There are some changes that I don't approve of. I mean, one of my pet peeves is referring to a microwave oven as a microwave. I mean, because that can lead to a little bit of confusion when somebody asks, are microwaves harmful? Well, you're talking about the oven or you're talking about the wave itself? So I wish they'd refer to a microwave oven as an oven, because you don't call a fire extinguisher a fire. Why would you call a microwave oven a microwave?
There's a lot of applications for microwave.
For communication purposes and radars based on microwave technology. But when you use the term microwave, you almost have to know in what context someone's talking. You're talking to a woman who works in the kitchen, or you're talking to an engineer. Some instructions will say, microwave on high for 2 minutes, and then leave in the microwave. Well, now, if you're leaving it for 2 minutes and then leaving it in the microwave, it's still cooking.
Yeah. But that, you kind of got to give people a break on that because to like 80% of the populace, microwave means microwave oven. They have no concept of any other use for the microwave.
Well, see, we live in a society in which we tend to overly abbreviate. We don't talk about shock absorbers. We talk about shocks. I'm going to get some shocks for my car. Well, why would somebody get shocks on a car? I mean, you want to absorb the shocks. You don't want to get them. But yet they'll talk about getting shocks or
what would
getting
you
your car smogged.
To
why would
to
you want
say,
to have
well,
your
that's
car
getting,
smogged?
Is there a realm where that's important versus unimportant?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, on Michael's Saturday special on KSEO about a month ago, they were talking about cell phones and whether or not they were harmful, and they were talking about microwaves. And parts of the conversation were a little difficult to follow because I wasn't sure how they were using the term microwave.
Well, I don't think they knew how to use the term microwave either, so there would be a wash there.
Well, I think the solution is let's just speak proper English and forget about, you know, trying to be sloppy. Like, kids these days don't even use capital letters or punctuation or spelling. You know, instead of saying Y-O-U, they use the letter U, and they don't put periods, so they run their sentences together, and it's almost like a puzzle to try to figure out what they're saying. You know, where did one thought end and a new one begin? Because they run them together, and they usually end up in such a way that they can be interpreted more than one way.
Did you watch the television show Star Trek very much?
A long time ago. I don't watch television much now.
Well, there was a prophetic episode they had of this. There was this big asteroid floating in outer space that had people in it, and they were the dumbest people that they'd ever met. They went the reason why they were dumb is because they were run by a computer, and this computer would tell them everything: when to eat, when to sleep, when to do this, when to do that. And the computer broke down, and so they were just floating around in outer space, lost, trying to figure out how to do things.
No, that asteroid's going to be called Earth, and it's going to be Obama, the computer, telling us what to do, and we're all just going to go, duh, yeah, he said do it. Well, let's do it.
Yeah. That's kind of, there's no independent thought. And no curiosity. Where did curiosity go?
I don't know. I think it's an extinct, endangered species or something.
Well,
yeah, when I was a kid, it seemed to me to always be more inquisitive, wanted to do things and try new things, and nowadays, kids, all they do is talk on cell phones and play video games and don't know up from down.
Well,
most of them don't even know the right way to wear a baseball cap. They all got it on backwards.
Curiosity went out when the cat died. Man, we're sounding old when we're talking about curiosity and how people spell and punctuation and everything. You know, why would that, you know, like I say, it matters in programming, but, you know, in everyday language. Actually, you know what might make people start to get more precise about their language if you started to write things like real estate contracts, legal lawsuits in the vernacular of the time. Sloppily, nothing precise, no periods, no punctuation, where you could leave a lot of ambiguity in the document. Yeah, I think there's probably a point in time where it probably matters less, and I think there's a point in time where it's incredibly important to be precise and specific. And I think that there's that whole realm in between, just like when does it become dark? When does it go from daylight to night?
Well, I think what happened is the powers that be, you know, advertising, marketing, the people in the upper echelons of companies that make decisions on product labeling and stuff, they have the idea that most of the populace are dumb as posts. You know, when I was a kid, I used to laugh when I would see Japanese stuff come that where a Japanese tried to write something on a bag of potato chips. They would call it super happy fun chip smile, you know. And you would laugh because they had no grasp of the language. You see the same thing now from American companies being marketed to people because they're like, these people are dummies. They don't even read the bag anyways. They just look at the funny colors and the pictures.
Hey, I got a question to ask you about your puzzle.
Yeah, the marble one?
On the marble one, yeah. Is there a precise answer? There are probabilities that are going to change with every draw of the marbles. You know, clearly.
No, there is a precise answer. There is no probability involved whatsoever.
You can't find it out before then?
You can't find out
then.
What?
In other words, clearly, if you pick one out of each of the three boxes, okay,
yeah,
two of the boxes are going to give you the same color marble.
At least two of them, yeah.
Yeah, at least two of them. Three of them can't give you all the same color marble because you got black, white, and mix.
That's right. So you're going to get a black one.
So you've narrowed it in the first draw of three down to two. The two of the same color. One of those two has to be pure, the other one has to be mixed.
Well, but so how does that give you the answer now?
No, I don't have the answer now. I'm just saying the first draw of three, I know that three will get me down to trying to select between two boxes.
Well,
okay.
Maybe I should tell you how many marbles, and then have you answer how you do it.
Vernon.
No, I don't want at that particular point. As you start to draw from the remaining two boxes, the mixed box is going to have a different. You know, clearly 50 would do it.
Oh well, yeah. If you pull out, you know, lots of marbles, yeah, you're going to.
Yeah, but you can also do it less than 50. But the approach to the problem I was using at this particular point is with each draw out of the mixed box that you don't hit it, the probability of hitting the same color marble or not getting the other color marble, the probability of getting the right one goes up, the probability of getting the wrong one goes down. So you know, you don't have to pull all 100 out clearly, but you're saying there's exact number of tries that will give you the answer unambiguously.
Well Ernest,
you go
yes.
ahead.
Well, I would say you only need to work on two boxes. Because once you've established an all-white one or an all-black one and the mixed one, you know what the third one's going to be. You don't even need to pull a marble out of the third one. So to me, that narrows it down to two boxes. And I figured three out of each box, you would have to get in the mixed one at least one white or one black with two of the other color. But now that's where I'm lost. How
not
many
necessarily
more
is all I'm saying is in the mixed box, all of your probabilities are the first pull, there's a 50-50 probability to pull out black or white. The second pull, one's going to have a 49 out of 99 versus, 48? I have to calculate that out. Because you've got 99 left. Of the 99 left, one you're going to have 50 of one and 49 of another. So on the second draw out of the mixed box, your probability of picking one is going to be greater than picking the other.
But there's no probabilities involved in the solution.
Okay, and that's all I was going to ask. When it hits me like a thunderbolt on top of the head, I'll give you an answer here. I don't have it yet, but it's just clear that after the first draw, you've got it narrowed down to two boxes. The question is how to know unambiguously in the second set of draws, or how many more draws you need to get it unambiguously.
Well. I'm just taking a shot in the dark here, and I would say 11 marbles out of two of the boxes. That would give me an 11% chance of getting different colors in the different colored box.
Yeah, but again, you're talking chances.
This is
a very deterministic problem.
Well, I don't know. I am stuck.
You failed becoming part of the Thinkers Club. Are you still doing the Thinkers Club, Mr. Logic?
As a matter of fact, I just got a new member last week, a member number 1,000.
1,000 people in the Thinkers Club. Maybe you should close it out right now so that's a nice, clean, round, unfuzzy number.
No, actually, the way it worked is somebody called in and answered to one of my questions, and he said, well, can I get a number in the club? And I said, well, we don't do the club anymore. You know, we had, I don't know how many, 700 some members or something. I didn't know the exact number. And so he suggested, well, why don't you start over again at 1,000? And I said, well, okay, if you want to do that, we'll make you member 1,000. So he became the first member in the new club now.
Oh, so we got a new Thinkers Club going.
Yeah.
What else are you doing these days? You're teaching programming. You're doing KSCO.
Teaching programming, doing simple, doing my talk show. Now what am I doing these days? Seems like I'm always busy doing something.
Any big major projects?
Nothing major, not really, no. I thought of taking a trip out of the country. I haven't gone anywhere for a while, but I still haven't taken any steps in that direction yet. So I guess I'm leading kind of a dull, boring life at the moment.
Where do you see the future of computing, the internet, this whole technological phenomenon we're in going? You know, you were back at the beginning. You know, people can read, they can read your bio. Is you finally bought your first one when it came all assembled. You didn't want to assemble your first computer. And then you worked for Apple for a while, writing software and programs for them. I assume are you working on both platforms these days, or primarily just Windows?
I'm only doing Windows. The main reason is because the Apple platform doesn't provide an easy-to-use programming language. And when I created Simple, I had to make a decision. Do I want to spend my time developing it for Windows, or do I want to do it for the Macintosh? And the Windows community far outweighed the Macintosh community at the time. So the obvious choice was to go with Windows.
Well, actually, it still does, I believe, doesn't it?
Probably still does, yeah.
By a long shot. I know the core of Apple, Macintosh users, iPad people, and all that are a very loyal body of people. But I think that they still, you know, when it comes to the iPhone, I was reading recently, I think that iPhones only occupy something like 20-22% of the smartphone market. So,
well, see, that's the other problem with going with Apple. When I started getting into the personal computer field back in the 1970s, Apple was a computer company. Now they're a telephone company. I didn't get into computing to become a telephone operator. I still like computing because I like programming. And when Apple kind of went off in a different tangent, that kind of made a bigger gap between what their goals are and my goals. So,
you know, I worked for someone that transitioned from Apple in the early days to PCs for kind of a similar reason. They said, you know, when they started getting into it, they could program and do things with the machine. And as the machine selectively became proprietary, you know, they were locked out, and the whole reason they were in computing had changed. So they went toward PCs and Windows-based machines.
Well, Windows, for better or for worse, I mean, Windows is what I'm stuck in now. I don't really want to develop cross-platform material. I'm not trying to expand my horizons or make my life more complicated than it already is. I'm happy with having just the Windows platform for Simple, because originally I wrote Simple just for me, actually, when it comes right down to it. I call it the programming language for kids. But it's actually the programming language for Bob Bishop. I made it because I wanted to have some fun writing programs, and like I did on the Apple II back in the old Apple days, anybody could sit down and write a program because it had AppleSoft Basic built into the computer. So you could write programs and have fun. And then when the Macintosh came out, Apple took away AppleSoft Basic. They no longer supplied any way for a user to make his own software. And with the Windows machines, they did the same thing. There was no longer any programming language. And so I was kind of frustrated. I was stuck there with, you know, in a hole with nothing to do except make my own programming language, and so I did. And so that's why I made Simple, and it's basically done for me so I can have fun. And I'm still having fun with it.
I asked the question again. Do you see any particular future or direction in terms of where the technology and the computer and things are going? Clearly, I think that they've become more of a toy than a work tool. A lot of people, you know, there's a lot of work that people still do on them. But, you know, as you start going to the pads and everything, it seems like there's less serious computing going on with the pads and everything. I could be wrong. I don't have one. And the other thing I find fascinating is there was a point in time where if you're going to be an artist or if you're going to be a musician or whatever, you had to, you know, you had to put a lot of time and effort in developing your musical skills or artistic skills. And what's happening is programmers these days are making it possible for people to simulate art, so to speak. And so do you think that'll diminish the importance of art in a culture or society?
Well, yeah, I mean, even like I was telling you, the Kaleido Draw program that took me 5 minutes to write, I guess you would classify that as an art type piece, interactive art, interactive dynamic art, which, by the way, I taught a class in interactive dynamic computer art at one of the schools up here about 5 years ago. And it basically what interactive dynamic computer art is, it's a fancy name for computer programming. What you do is I taught kids how to draw pictures, how to make them animate, move around on the screen and control with your mouse and do all kinds of fun little things like that, which have practically no real application except that they're kind of fun to make. And when you see it come to life on the screen, it's a thrill. I mean, you know, kids can do something very trivial, just move a circle on the screen. When they move the mouse, the circle moves. And they go, oh, wow, look what I did. Hey, look at this thing. Hey, you know, they just get all this excited thing about, you know, being able to make the computer do something like that. And I can understand that because that's the way I was.
Hey, I've got to go on a little bit, but before I do, can I ask Vernon, you and Mr. Logic a riddle?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, and it'll kind of date you on this. It's not a mathematic riddle, though. It's on a cold January day, a 43-year-old man was sworn in as chief executive of his country. By his side stood his predecessor, a famous general who 15 years previously had commanded his country's armed forces in a war which resulted in the total defeat of the German nation. This young man was brought up in the Roman Catholic faith, and after the ceremony, spent 5 hours reviewing a parade in his honor and stayed up until 3 a.m. celebrating. Who was it?
This is a question about history.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not much of a historian, I must confess.
That's something you and I have in common. I managed to skate out of history when in high school.
I would suspect, though, it's probably somebody you wouldn't suspect. Probably somebody like George Washington or something like that.
Well, who would you suspect?
Well, I guess I could imagine it might be somebody who I know it probably isn't, but I'd probably say like Eisenhower or I don't know. Who is it?
I would suspect Truman. I would suspect Truman.
Was he Catholic?
Say that again, Don.
Was he Catholic? This guy was raised.
I don't know, but
Roman
I think Eisenhower was Protestant.
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
means
I wouldn't
fit that description from what I knew, or your description from what I know, would be Truman or Eisenhower.
Most people get. Yeah.
Could have been Kennedy. He was Catholic, right?
That's what most people would guess would be John F. Kennedy, but the answer is Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, I thought it would be something like that, something you wouldn't expect.
Yeah.
Well, we fail history, Mr. Logic. See, Don's getting even at you for his Marvel puzzle.
Well,
are you going to give the answer to the Marvel deal?
Well, let's see. Well, you have to end at 6 o'clock tonight. Is that right?
No, I can go into overtime, but people that don't call in can't listen to the answer. They have to listen to it in the archives. At 6 o'clock, I cut off. That's the other thing that's a little bit different on internet radio and the show I'm doing, is I have the ability to go into overtime and go past the allotted time. It just cuts off on the internet feed, and then we continue on until we're typically done. But for those listening in the chat room, it would be nice for them to be able to hear the answer before we go. So go ahead, give it.
Okay, I'll give the answer, but I won't explain. I'll give you half the answer. I'll tell you how many marbles total need to be taken out, and it'll be up to you to tell me which box or boxes they come from and how that would then tell you how to put the correct labels. The total number of marbles that you need to remove, the grand total, is one marble. Now, which box do you take it from, and how do you then put the correct labels on?
Oh, boy. Could I bother you to say to tell the riddle one more time?
Well, you have three boxes sitting up on the shelf. You can't look into them because they're too high up, but you can reach in and pull out as many marbles as you want from any of the boxes. One of the boxes has 50 white marbles, one has 50 black, and the remainder has a mixture, or I forget what the numbers are, 100 did I say, or 50, it doesn't matter. It has a certain number of marbles, and the third box is has a mixture of half of one, half the other. And the question is, if all the all the boxes are mislabeled, how would you put the correct label on each box?
And a grand total of one marble.
That's right. You take one marble from one of the boxes, and that's all you need to know.
Wait, didn't you say one marble?
Yep, one marble.
One marble from one of the boxes.
That's right. Not one from each box, just one total.
No. One total. Oh, boy. I am absolutely stumped.
Well, just think about it. How you know the answer, which is sort of half the answer, half the question here, half the solution. Just ask yourself, which box would you take it from?
Well, since I don't know how they are from left to right.
Doesn't matter. They're just up there. I mean, let's just say one of the boxes is labeled black, one is labeled white, and one is labeled mixture. Which labeled box do you pull it from?
I would say that you would pick one marble from the box marked black. And
okay,
see what
suppose you pull a marble out of the black box labeled black and you get a white marble.
Then I would switch it with the black marked box and say
well,
that
how
the
do you
black
know it wasn't a box but it had the mixture?
You mean that the one marked mixture has the black label on it?
Well, I mean, it could be. I mean, the one that's marked mixture is definitely wrong, so that means it has to either be all black or all white, right?
Right. I don't know. And how about you, Vernon? Are you going to flunk math on top of history?
I think Vern is checking something on his computer or something.
Yeah, because if I pull a black marble out of a white box, then I know I'd have a 50-50 chance that that's either the mixed box or the black box.
Yeah, that's right.
That's kind of the you know how you have the three curtains on
let's
the price
make a deal.
Of life. Yeah, let's make a deal.
Yeah, that's the Monty Hall paradox.
I had my mic muted.
With the let's make a deal thing, if you want to pick curtain two, don't pick it. Pick curtain three because you can figure that the curtain you picked is no good. So the other two, you have a 50-50 chance of getting a good price. So pick curtain three.
No, each curtain has the same chance.
Yeah.
But that's another interesting question. It's the Monty Hall question.
Yeah, but that marble thing, you know, picking one marble out of one box, if it's labeled black and you pull out a white, you have a 50-50 chance that that is the white box.
That's right. So therefore, you wouldn't want to pull a marble out of that box, would you?
Well, I already did.
No, then you made the wrong choice.
Yeah, then I made the wrong choice.
So what would be the right choice?
Well, it's black and white. You've got mixture, solid. You can't tell the mixed one unless you take at least three or four out. So that one you have to throw away. So
well,
it has to be.
You're making a false assumption here. You're forgetting one of the facts that was given in the puzzle.
Yeah, folks, we've got 90 seconds. If you want to hear the answer here, you can call in. Otherwise, you have to listen in archives. I'll type it in chat, too.
Well, one box is a 50-50 mixture of black and white, right?
Yep.
And one box is all black and one box is all white.
Yep.
You'd pull it out of the one that says mixed.
That's correct. Vernon's got the right answer, but now how does that tell you the correct labels?
Huh? Well, you know, clearly if you pull it out of the mix and it's white, okay, you know that they're switched. And so the white one goes on that one. They're all in the wrong boxes. If you pull it out of the white one and it's let's say, black, okay?
And like you pull what out?
No, if you pull one out of the mixed box, okay?
Right, one that says mixture, yeah.
Mixture, and it's going to be black or white.
Yeah, let's assume
right?
It's black.
Okay, then you know that the black label goes on it.
That's
okay?
Right.
Okay?
What
yep. you also know, because there are two possibilities at that particular point, is you know that the other pure colored one has to be on the one marked mixed.
Well, you know that once you put the black marble on the box label, a black label on the box that was labeled mixture, what are you going to do with the mixture label? You can't just put it on. You can't just swap it with the one that came from the
black. No, but here, you know that the labels are all wrong. So if the mixture label is on the black one, okay,
yeah.
Then what you have to have is the black's got to be on the white and the white's got to be on the mixture.
Yeah.
And if the mixture labels is on the white, then the white's got to be on the black and the black's got to be on the mixture. So if
yeah.
you pull the mixture marble, it's a determining it determines where the other ones are going to go based on the color it comes out.
Exactly.
I still don't follow it. My mind is thinking,
listen,
you know. Yeah.
Listen to Vernon here. Okay, V cubed. The labels are on the wrong boxes, right?
Right.
So let's say you can draw out the chart very quickly. Is you can say, well, let's say that the mixed is on the black can't be on the black, so the black's got to be on the white or the mixture, right? The mixture
right.
can't be on the mixture, so you either have to have the white on the black, right, or the mixture on the black, right? Are you with me so far?
Yeah.
I'm setting up the two conditions, one of two conditions you have. If you have the mixture on the white, on the black, then the black's got to be on the white, and the white's got to be on the mixture. With me so far?
Well, what if you pull
the
white marble out of the mixture?
If in fact the mixture is on the white, then the white's got to be up on the black, and the black's got to be on the mixture.
Oh, no, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I didn't even think. It's all in the labels. It's not in the marbles. Okay.
Right, so you have to, if you pick the mixture box, depending on which one comes out, will determine where the other, where the labels go.
You're right. Okay, yeah, that's where I was lost, was on the label. Well, thanks for the, Mr. Logic. You are logical, and I don't know why I didn't even think of it. I've talked about not seeing the forest for the trees. And thanks a bunch, Vernon.
And that, by the way, Don, before
yeah.
you hang up, that's why Mr. Logic said it's a different problem if none of the labels are on any of the boxes.
Yeah.
Right,
okay,
Mr. Logic? Because
yeah.
if they're not on the
yeah.
boxes, it changes the whole scenario.
Yeah, because now you don't have that extra information that knowing each one was wrong.
Right. Okay, well, you guys have a good weekend now.
Well, thank you too, Don. Really, thanks as usual for calling, and really appreciate it. I'm going to type this in the chat room if they can't hear us, if they're still around. Did you get the answer, Tule? There's two guests. Okay, I just typed a line in chat. Well, listen, I want to. Don just dropped. Let's see. Here we go. Got a caller here. 585.
Hey, Vern, it's me. Hey, Vern, it's me too. So what was the answer again? I'm sorry.
The answer is you pull the marble. You pull the marble from the one marked mixed, and it will tell you. It will determine where the other two labels go.
Ah, but then you still have to find out which one is black and which one is white.
No, that's automatically determined. But what I said was, and we were probably cut off and into overtime. is the labels are all on the wrong boxes, right? So you got solid black, solid white, solid mixed. There are two possible cases, right? The mixed can be on the black, right? In which case the black is on the white and the white is on the mixed. Or the mixed could be on the white, in which case the white would have to be on the black and the black would be on the mixed. So depending on what you pick, you know that's not the mixed one. Whatever the color is happens to be the color that would be on. Let's see, am I explaining this right? The color will be on the bar. I put my paper aside. So that will totally determine when you pick the mixed box. The mixed box will give you a black or a white, and that will, whatever color comes out of that box is the label that goes on there. You know that the remaining label that's solid colored is on the wrong one, so it's got to come off, and the mixed goes there, and the remaining color label goes on the third box. I don't know if I said that very clearly. You can say it more clearly for me, Mr. Logic.
Well, simply put, let's start from the beginning. You got three boxes all incorrectly labeled. So you reach into the box that has a label that says mixture. Well, whatever color comes out, you know that has to be the color of all the marbles in that box because it is not a mixture, even because the label says so, and you know the label's wrong.
I'm sorry, I don't get it, but it sounds like my typical day. I just don't get it. I work on computers sometimes, repairing them, and it seems like a typical scenario. It should do what it's supposed to do, but okay.
Let me try it again. Since all the labels are off, right?
Okay.
The only way all the labels can be off is if the mixed label is on the box whose color marble you pick out. If the mixed label is on the black, you know that black, that set of marbles is black, right? You know that the white label can't be on the white one, so it would have to have been on the mixed. Are you with me?
Oh, gotcha. So there are labels, it's just they're off. They're in the wrong
position.
Yeah,
they're all mixed. They're all on the wrong boxes.
Oh, okay.
It's the label that has the information. So if you pull out of the one mark mixed, you automatically know when you pull the marble out of the one mark mixed, that's the color of the marbles in that box.
Oh, you know, I got it. All right, yeah. Just see, it's stuff like that just explains my concept. The question is almost more important than the answer. If you could find the perfect question, you will get the answer. Am I making sense? Like a minute ago,
there again, what was central to this question is Don pointed out, is everyone ignored half of the important information. Everyone focused on the marbles in the box and forgot about. And remember, I asked that. I phrased it in the beginning of the question. And so you have three boxes. One's got black, one's got white, one's got mixed. And you got three sets of labels, black, white, and mixed. And Mr. Logic says, no, that's a different problem. The labels are on the boxes. They're just not on the right boxes. That's what determines the answers. If you don't have the labels on the wrong boxes, then it's a whole different problem.
Okay, cool.
And so listen, for people listening in archives, since we've gone in overtime, what's kind of a fun take-home lesson, if you will, on this, is that when you're solving and dealing with problems, if you don't have the problem properly defined in terms of what you're working with, it's almost impossible to come up with a solution. So that when you're solving problems, it behooves us all to pay attention to the nature of the problem before we launch off trying to solve it.
Can I ask the guest host a question real quick, Vern?
Sure.
So what subject matter do you deal on your show? I love technical stuff. and I want to know more about your show. Do you do in computer programming or stuff like that?
Not on the show, no. I mean, I'll cover lots of topics. They range from philosophy, astronomy, mathematics, logic, kind of a hodgepodge of different things, but they all border on technical things rather. I don't talk about politics. I don't talk about the weather, well, except from a scientific point of view. I don't talk about cooking or how to make a meatloaf or anything like that. I mean, I deal mostly with kind of the stuff like Vern does.
All right. Awesome. And one last question. When you work for Apple, did you find Steve Jobs to be like a moron? I seen this video about him, and it made it seem like he was like a real moron, like a micromanaged.
Let's say he was a little bit overrated by the press. My first experience with Steve Jobs was before I even worked at Apple. This is back around 1976, I guess, 75, somewhere around there. I went up to visit him. He took me out to his garage in the back of the house. He had an Apple I computer, and I was thinking of getting an Apple computer, and so he took me out to show me how to use it, and he couldn't get it to work. I mean, he didn't build it. I mean, it was Steve Wozniak built the machine, and Steve Wozniak showed him how to use it, but he couldn't remember how. So anyway,
I always figured that it was Steve Wozniak that was the smarter one, but I didn't know Steve Jobs was that bad. I thought that he had some knowledge. Wow, that's now.
Well, he may have improved in later years. I mean, this is back when he was about 21 or so. Maybe being at Apple and whatever may have helped his education or something. But back in those days, he wasn't particularly a whiz kid scholar.
Now, this documentary that I seen on Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, I'm pretty sure you've seen it, Pirates of Silicon Valley
Pirates of Silicon Valley. Yeah, I think I remember seeing most of it.
Now, in that that movie, they said that Steve Jobs was doing acid and all that type of stuff. Is that true? Was he a real drug head?
I didn't know him that well. I mean, I knew him, he knew me. But we weren't chummy buddies. That we knew each other's, personal lives all that well.
Cool. All right. I have to go buy a monitor. Thanks for taking my call. I'll see you again later, and I'll check out your show sometime.
All right, thanks.
All right? Okay, bye-bye.
Well, Mr. Logic, thank you very much for the generosity of your time, and I thoroughly enjoyed having you on as my guest today. I hope it was a pleasurable experience for you.
Oh, yeah, it's always good to talk with you. I haven't talked with you in years, so, yeah, it's good. We ought to do this more often.
we certainly will. I will have you as a regular guest on the docket. I do listen on Sundays, and like I say, it was my pleasure to have you as a guest. You are now in the archives. As soon as I hang up here, the show will be archived, and people will start listening to it on podcast. Kind of a cool, phenomenal thing. All I have to do is have the account. I didn't have to program any of it. But that doesn't take away from the power of it. It certainly is a tool that's available to me that I appreciate. So,
it's something I might consider doing eventually too. But right now, doing KSEO is probably enough of I wouldn't say a full-time challenge, but it's enough to and keep me busy at the moment. But if ever I leave KSEO, KOMY, and I want to continue doing talk radio type stuff, I'll probably end up doing something like this too.
Well, I'll send you some information email-wise. I want to close by telling you one thing. I got your lead-in music for your Sunday show, The Thinking Machine.
Uh-huh.
And lo and behold, guess what? In spite of all the software I have, the Blog Talk Radio Studio will only let me upload MP3, WAV, or WMA files. And the program that I do a lot of audio work in, I have a couple of them that work. Neither one of them was quite able. They wanted me to define the MIDI instruments used. And I was thinking, I wonder if I could have done that using Simple.
What you might have been able to do would be to play the MIDI file and make a wave recording of it.
I started to do that in the end. I just had the wrong sets of things plugged in. I know that was certainly one way I could do it. But I thought, that's the first thing it did. I have a program I've used for years that works. I've been using it since 1995. It's by a company called Magix. It's Music Maker, and it really does a lot of good stuff. And I could have converted it to any number of MIDI instruments, but I wanted to keep the same pure sound you had. And was unable to achieve that prior to the show. I tried to.
Well, that's okay. Doesn't matter. It's not a piece of music that I created or anything. So it's just something I use as a bumper, and it was just something that I found that was it was the least objectionable of all the possible candidates I was able to locate.
Well, listen, until next time, like I say, it's been a delight for me. I certainly thank you for taking the time with me being on the show. It's been nice chatting with you. As you said, it's been a long time since we had a chance to sit down and talk, and we will definitely do it again. I'll be listening tomorrow. For the rest of my listeners, I hope you enjoyed Mr. Logic as much as me. Go back. If the puzzle didn't make sense to you, figure it out for yourself. And until next time, folks, I'll see you next Saturday after 9 noon. My name is Vernon Bohr, a.k.a. Vernon, a.k.a. V-Cubed.
Until next time, always remember to keep an open mind and question everything, especially the
self-evident.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Bob.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.